From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Master of Rambling Gate by Anne Rice. Spring, 1888. Rambling Gate. It was so real to us in the old pictures, rising like a fairy tale castle out of its own dark wood. A wilderness of gables and chimneys between those two immense towers, gray stone walls mantled in ivy, mullioned windows reflecting the drifting clouds. But why had Father never taken us there? And why, on his deathbed, had he told my brother that Rambling Gate must be torn down, stone by stone? "I should have done it, Richard," he said. "But I was born in that house, as my father was, and his father before him. You must do it now, Richard. It has no claim on you. Tear it down." Was it any wonder that not 2 months after Father's passing, Richard and I were on the noon train headed south for the mysterious mansion that had stood upon the rise above the village of Rambling for 400 years? Surely Father would have understood. How could we destroy the old place when we had never seen it? But as the train moved slowly through the outskirts of London, I can't say we were very sure of ourselves, no matter how curious and excited we were. Richard had just finished 4 years at Oxford. 2 whirlwind social seasons in London had proved me something of a shy success. I still preferred scribbling poems and stories in my room to dancing the night away, but I'd kept that a good secret. And though we had lost our mother when we were little, Father had given us the best of everything. Now the carefree years were ended. We had to be independent and wise. The evening before, we had pored over all the old pictures of Rambling Gate, recalling in hushed, tentative voices the night Father had taken those pictures down from the walls. I couldn't have been more than 6, and Richard 8 when it happened. Yet we remembered well the strange incident in Victoria Station that had precipitated Father's uncharacteristic rage. We had gone there after supper to say farewell to a school friend of Richard's, and Father had caught a glimpse, quite unexpectedly, of a young man at the lighted window of an incoming train. I could remember the young man's face clearly to this day. Remarkably handsome, with a head of lustrous brown hair, his large black eyes regarding Father with the saddest expression as Father drew back. "Unspeakable horror," Father had whispered. Richard and I had been too amazed to speak a word. Later that night, Father and Mother quarreled, and we crept out of our rooms to listen on the stairs. "That he should dare to come to London," Father said over and over. "Is it not enough for him to be the undisputed master of Rambling Gate?" How we puzzled over it as little ones. Who was this stranger, and how could he be master of a house that belonged to our father, a house that had been left in the care of an old blind housekeeper for years? But now, after looking at the pictures again, it was too dreadful to think of Father's exhortation, and too exhilarating to think of the house itself. I'd pack my manuscripts, for who knew? Maybe in that melancholy and exquisite setting I'd find exactly the inspiration I needed for the story I'd been writing in my head. Yet there was something almost illicit about the excitement I felt. I saw in my mind's eye the pale young man again, with his black greatcoat and red woolen cravat. Like bone china his complexion had been, strange to remember so vividly, and I realized now that in those few remarkable moments he had created for me an ideal of masculine beauty that I had never questioned since. But Father had been so angry, I felt an unmistakable pang of guilt. It was late afternoon when the old trap carried us up the gentle slope from the little railway station, and we had our first real look at the house. The sky had paled to a deep rose hue beyond a bank of softly gilded clouds, and the last rays of the sun struck the uppermost panes of the leaded windows and filled them with solid gold. "Oh, but it's too majestic," I whispered. "Too like a great cathedral, and to think that it belongs to us." Richard gave me the smallest kiss on the cheek. I wanted with all my heart to jump down from the trap and draw near on foot, letting those towers slowly grow larger and larger above me, but our old horse was gaining speed. When we reached the massive front door, Richard and I were spirited into the great hall by the tiny figure of the blind housekeeper, Mrs. Blessington, our footfalls echoing loudly on the marble tile, and our eyes dazzled by the dusty shafts of light that fell on the long oak table and its heavily carved chairs, the somber tapestries that stirred ever so slightly against the soaring walls. "Richard, it is an enchanted place," I cried, unable to contain myself. Mrs. Blessington laughed gaily, her hand closing tightly on mine. We found our bedchambers well aired, with snow-white linen on the beds and fires blazing cozily on the hearths. The small diamond-paned windows opened on a glorious view of the lake and the oaks that enclosed it, and the few scattered lights that marked the village beyond. That night we laughed like children as we supped at the great oak table, our candles giving only a feeble light, and afterwards we had a fierce battle of pocket billiards in the games room, and a little too much brandy, I fear. It was just before I went to bed that I asked Mrs. Blessington if there had been anyone in this house since my father left it years before. "No, my dear," she said quickly, fluffing the feather pillows. "When your father went away to Oxford, he never came back." "There was never a young intruder after that?" I pressed her, though in truth I had little appetite for anything that would disturb the happiness I felt. How I loved the Spartan cleanliness of this bedchamber, the walls bare of paper and ornament, the high luster of the walnut-paneled bed. "A young intruder?" With an unerring certainty about her surroundings, she lifted the poker and stirred the fire. "No, dear. Whatever made you think there was?" "Are there no ghost stories, Mrs. Blessington?" I asked suddenly, startling myself. Unspeakable horror. But what was I thinking? That young man had not been real? "Oh, no, darling," she said, smiling. "No ghost would ever dare to trouble Rampling Gate." Nothing, in fact, troubled the serenity of the days that followed. Long walks through the overgrown garden, trips in the little skiff to and fro across the lake, tea under the hot glass of the empty conservatory. Early evening found us reading and writing by the library fire. All our inquiries in the village met with the same answers. The villagers cherished the house. There was not a single disquieting legend or tale. How were we going to tell them of Father's edict? How were we going to remind ourselves? Richard was finding a wealth of classical material on the library shelves, and I had the desk in the corner entirely to myself. Never had I known such quiet. It seemed the atmosphere of Rampling Gate permeated my simplest written descriptions and wove its way richly into the plots and characters I created. The Monday after our arrival, I finished my first real short story, and after copying out a fresh draft, I went off to the village on foot to post it boldly to the editors of Blackwood's magazine. It was a warm afternoon, and I took my time as I came back. What had disturbed our father so about this lovely corner of England? What had so darkened his last hours that he laid his curse upon this spot? My heart opened to his unearthly stillness, to an indisputable magnificence that caused me utterly to forget myself. There were times here when I felt I was a disembodied intellect drifting through a fathomless silence, up and down garden paths and stone corridors that had witnessed too much to take cognizance of one small and fragile young woman who in random moments actually talked aloud to the suits of armor around her, to the broken statues in the garden, the fountain cherubs who had had no water to pour from their conscience for years and years. But was there in this loveliness some malignant force that was eluding us still, some untold story? Unspeakable horror. Even in the flood of brilliant sunlight, those words gave me a chill. As I came slowly up the slope, I saw Richard walking lazily along the uneven shore on the lake. Now and then he glanced up at the distant battlements, his expression dreamy, almost blissfully contented. Rambling Gate had him, and I understood perfectly because it also had me. With a new sense of determination, I went to him and placed my hand gently on his arm. For a moment he looked at me as if he did not even know me, and then he said softly, "How will I ever do it, Julie? And one way or the other, it will be on my conscience all my life." "It's time to seek advice, Richard," I said. "Write to our lawyers in London. Write to Father's clergyman, Dr. Matthews. Explain everything. We cannot do this alone." It was 3 o'clock in the morning when I opened my eyes, but I had been awake for a long time, and I felt not fear, lying there alone, but something else, some vague and relentless agitation, some sense of emptiness and need that caused me finally to rise from my bed. What was this house really? A place or merely a state of mind? What was it doing to my soul? I felt overwhelmed, yet shut out of some great and dazzling secret, driven by an unbearable restlessness. I pulled on my woolen wrapper and my slippers and went into the hall. The moonlight fell full on the oak stairway and the vestibule far below. Maybe I could write of the confusion I suffered now, put on paper the inexplicable longing I felt. Certainly it was worth the effort, and I made my way soundlessly down the steps. The great hall gaped before me, the moonlight here and there touching upon a pair of cross swords or a mounted shield. But far beyond, in the alcove just outside the library, I saw the uneven glow of the fire. So Richard was there. A sense of well-being pervaded me and quieted me. At the same time, the distance between us seemed endless, and I became desperate to cross it, hurrying past the long supper table and finally into the alcove before the library doors. The fire blazed beneath the stone mantelpiece, and a figure sat in the leather chair before it, bent over a loose collection of pages that he held in his slender hands. He was reading the pages eagerly, and the fire suffused his face with a warm, golden light. But it was not Richard. It was the same young man I had seen on the train in Victoria Station 15 years ago, and not a single aspect of that taut young face had changed. There was the very same hair, thick and lustrous, and only carelessly combed as it hung to the collar of his black coat, and those dark eyes that looked up suddenly and fixed me with the most curious expression as I almost screamed. We stared at each other across the shadowy room, I stranded in the doorway, he visibly and undeniably shaken that I had caught him unawares. My heart stopped. And in a split second he rose and moved towards me, closing the gap between us, reaching out with those slender white hands. "Julie," he whispered in a voice so low that it seemed my own thoughts were speaking to me. But this was no dream. He was holding me, and the scream had broken loose from me, deafening, uncontrollable, and echoing from the four walls. I was alone. Clutching at the door frame, I staggered forward, and then in a moment of perfect clarity, I saw the young stranger again. Saw him standing in the open door to the garden, looking back over his shoulder. Then he was gone. I could not stop screaming. I could not stop, even as I heard Richard's voice calling me, heard his feet pound down the broad hollow staircase and through the great hall. I could not stop, even as he shook me, pleaded with me, settled me in a chair. Finally, I managed to describe what I had seen. "But you know who it was," I said almost hysterically. "It was he, the young man from the train." "Now wait," Richard said. "He had his back to the fire, Julie, and you could not see his face clearly. Richard, it was he. Don't you understand? He touched me. He called me Julie," I whispered. "Good God, Richard, look at the fire. I didn't light it. He did. He was here." All but pushing Richard out of the way, I went to the heap of papers that lay strewn on the carpet before the hearth. "My story," I whispered, snatching up the pages. "He's been reading my story, Richard, and, dear God, he's read your letters. The letters to Mr. Partridge and Dr. Matthews about tearing down the house." Surely you don't believe it was the same man, Julie, after all these years. But he has not changed, Richard. Not in the smallest detail. There is no mistake, I tell you. It was the very same man. The next day was the most trying since we had come. Together we commenced a search of the house. Darkness found us only half finished. Frustrated everywhere by locked doors we could not open in old staircases that were not safe. And it was also quite clear by supper time that Richard did not believe I had seen anyone in the study at all. As for the fire, well, he had failed to put it out properly before going to bed, and the pages, well, one of us had put them there and forgotten them, of course. But I knew what I had seen, and what obsessed me more than anything else was the gentle countenance of the mysterious man I had glimpsed, the innocent eyes that had fixed on me for one moment before I screamed. "You would be wise to do one very important thing before you retire," I said crossly. "Leave out a note to the effect that you do not intend to tear down the house." "Julie, you have created an impossible dilemma," Richard declared, the color rising in his face. "You insist we reassure this apparition that the house will not be destroyed, when in fact you verify the existence of the very creature that drove our father to say what he did." "Oh, I wish I had never come here," I burst out suddenly. "Then we should go and decide this matter at home." "No, that's just it. I could never go without knowing. I could never go on living with knowing now." Anger must be an excellent antidote to fear, for surely something worked to alleviate my natural alarm. I did not undress that night, but rather sat in the darkened bedroom, gazing at the small square of diamond-pane window until I heard the house fall quiet. When the grandfather clock in the great hall chimed the hour of 11, Rampling Gate was as usual fast asleep. I felt a dark exultation as I imagined myself going out of the room and down the stairs. But I knew I should wait one more hour. I should let the night reach its peak. My heart was beating too fast, and dreamily I recollected the face I had seen, the voice that had said my name. Why did it seem in retrospect so intimate, that we had known each other before, spoken together a thousand times? Was it because he had read my story, those words that came from my very soul? "Who are you?" I believe I whispered aloud. "Where are you at this moment?" I uttered the word. "Come." The door opened without a sound, and he was standing there. He was dressed exactly as he had been the night before, and his dark eyes were riveted on me with that same obvious curiosity, his mouth just a little slack, like that of a boy. I sat forward, and he raised his finger, as if to reassure me, and gave a little nod. "Oh, it is you," I whispered. "Yes," he said in a soft, unobtrusive voice. "And you are not a spirit?" I looked at his mud-splattered boots, at the faintest smear of dust on that perfect white cheek. "A spirit?" he asked almost mournfully. What that I were that? Dazed, I watched him come towards me. The room darkened, and I felt his cool silken hands on my face. I had risen. I was standing before him, and I looked up into his eyes. I heard my own heartbeat. I heard it as I had the night before, right at the moment I had screamed. Dear God, I was talking to him. He was in my room, and I was talking to him. And then suddenly, I was in his arms. "Real? Absolutely real," I whispered, in a low, zinging sensation coursed through me, so that I had to steady myself. He was peering at me as if trying to comprehend something terribly important. His lips had a ruddy look to them, a soft look for all his handsomeness, as if he had never been kissed. A slight dizziness came over me, a slight confusion which I was not at all sure that he was even there. "Oh, but I am," he said, as if I had spoken my doubt. I felt his breath against my cheek, and it was almost sweet. "I am here, and I have watched you ever since you came." "Yes?" My eyes were closing. In a dim flash, as of a match being struck, I saw my father, heard his voice. "No, Julie," but that was surely a dream. "Only a little kiss," said the voice of the one who was really here. I felt his lips against my neck. I would never harm you. No harm ever for the children of this house. Just the little kiss, Julie, and the understanding that it imparts, that you cannot destroy Rambling Gate, Julie, that you can never, never drive me away. The core of my being, that secret place where all desires and all commandments are nurtured, open to him without a struggle or a sound. I would have fallen if he had not held me. My arms closed about him, my hands slipping into the soft silken mass of his hair. I was floating, and there was, as there had always been at Rambling Gate, an endless peace. It was Rambling Gate I felt enclosing me. It was that timeless and impenetrable secret that had opened itself at last, a power within me of enormous ken, to see as a god sees and take the depth of things as nimbly as the outward eyes can size and shape pervade. Yes, those very words from Keats, which I had quoted in the pages of my story that he had read. But in a violent instant he had released me. "Too innocent," he whispered. I went reeling across the bedroom floor and caught hold of the frame of the window. I rested my forehead against the stone wall. There was a tingling pain in my throat where his lips had touched me that was almost pleasurable, a delicious throbbing that would not stop. I knew what he was. I turned and saw all the room clearly, the bed, the fireplace, the chair. And he stood still exactly as I'd left him, and there was the most appalling anguish in his face. "Something of menace, unspeakable menace," I whispered, backing away. "Something ancient, something that defies understanding," he pleaded. "Something that can and will go on." But he was shaken, and he would not look into my eyes. I touched that pulsing pain with the tips of my fingers, and looking down at them, saw the blood. "Vampire," I gasped. "And yet you suffer so, and it is as if you can love." "Love? I've loved you since you came. I loved you when I read your secret thoughts, and I had not yet seen your face." He drew me to him ever so gently, and slipping his arm around me, guided me to the door. I tried for one desperate moment to resist him, and as any gentleman might, he stepped back respectfully and took my hand. Through the long upstairs corridor we passed, and through a small wooden doorway to a screw stair that I had not seen before. I soon realized we were ascending in the North Tower, a ruined portion of the structure that had been sealed off years before. Through one tiny window after another, I saw the gently rolling landscape and the small cluster of dim lights that marked the village of Rambling and the pale streak of white that was the London Road. Up and up we climbed until we reached the topmost chamber, and this he opened with an iron key. He held back the door for me to enter, and I found myself in a spacious room whose high, narrow window contained no glass. A flood of moonlight revealed the most curious mixture of furnishings and objects. A writing table, a great shelf of books, soft leather chairs, and scores of maps and framed pictures affixed to the walls. Candles all about had dripped their wax on every surface, and in the very midst of this chaos lay my poems, my old sketches, early writings that I had brought with me and never even unpacked. I saw a black silk top hat and a walking stick, and a bouquet of withered flowers, dry as straw, and daguerreotypes and tintypes in their little velvet cases, and London newspapers and open books. There was no place for sleeping in this room. And when I thought of that, where he must lie when he went to rest, a shudder passed over me, and I felt, quite palpably, his lips touching my throat again. And I had the sudden urge to cry. But he was holding me in his arms. He was kissing my cheeks and my lips ever so softly. "My father knew what you were," I whispered. "Yes," he answered. "And his father before him. And all of them in an unbroken chain over the years. Out of loneliness or rage, I know not which, I always told them. I always made them acknowledge, accept." I backed away, and he didn't try to stop me. He lighted the candles about us one by one. I was stunned by the sight of him in the light, the gleam in his large black eyes, and the gloss of his hair. Not even in the railway station had I seen him so clearly as I did now, amid the radiance of the candle. He broke my heart. And yet he looked at me as though I were a feast for his eyes. And he said my name again, and I felt the blood rush to my face. But there seemed a great break suddenly in the passing of time. What had I been thinking? Yes, never tell, never disturb. Something ancient, something greater than good and evil. But no, I felt dizzy again. I heard Father's voice. Tear it down, Richard, stone by stone. He had drawn me to the window, and as the lights of Rampling were subtracted from the darkness below, a great wood stretched out in all directions, far older and denser than the forest of Rampling Gate. I was afraid suddenly, as if I were slipping into a maelstrom of visions from which I could never of my own will return. There was that sense of our talking together, talking and talking in low, agitated voice, and I was saying that I should not give in. Bear witness, that is all I ask of you, Julie. And there was in me some dim certainty that by these visions alone I would be fatally changed. But the very room was losing its substance, as if a soundless wind of terrific force were blowing it apart. The vision had already begun. We were riding horseback through a forest, he and I, and the trees were so high and so thick that scarcely any sun at all broke through to the fragrant, leaf-strewn ground. Yet we had no time to linger in this magical place. We had come to the fresh-tilled earth that surrounded a village I somehow knew was called Norwood, with its gabled roofs and its tiny crooked streets. We saw the monastery of Norwood and the little church with the bell chiming, vespers under the low, erring sky. A great bustling life recited in Norwood, a thousand voices rising in common prayer. Far beyond, on the rise above the forest, stood the round tower of a truly ancient castle. And to that ruined castle, no more than a shell of itself any more, as darkness fell in earnest we rode. Through its empty chambers we roamed, impetuous children, the horses and the road quite forgotten, and to the lord of the castle, a gaunt and white-skinned creature, standing before the roaring fire of the roofless hall we came. He turned and fixed us with his narrow and glittering eyes. A dead thing he was, I understood, but he carried within himself a priceless magic, and my companion, my innocent young man, stepped forward into the Lord's arms. I saw the kiss. I saw the young man grow pale and struggle and turn away, and the Lord retreated with the wisest, saddest smile. I understood. I knew. But the castle was dissolving as surely as anything in this dream might dissolve, and we were in some damp and close place. The stench was unbearable to me. It was the most terrible of all stenches, the stench of death, and I heard my steps on the cobblestones, and I reached out to steady myself against the wall. The tiny marketplace was deserted. The doors and windows gaped open to the vagrant wind. Up one side and down the other of the crooked street, I saw the marks in the houses, and I knew what the marks meant. The Black Death had come to the village of Norwood. The Black Death had laid it waste. And in a moment of suffocating horror, I realized that no one, not a single person, was left alive. But this was not quite true. There was a young man walking in fits and starts up the narrow alleyway. He was staggering, almost falling, as he pushed in one door after another, and at last came to a hot, reeking place where a child screamed on the floor. Mother and father lay dead in the bed, and the sleek, fat cat of the household, unharmed, played with a screaming infant, whose eyes bulged in its tiny, sunken face. "Stop it!" I heard myself gasp. I was holding my head with both hands. "Stop it! Stop it, please!" I was screaming, and my screams would surely pierce the vision, and this crude little dwelling would collapse around me, and I would rouse the household of Rampling Gate, but I did not. The young man turned and stared at me, and in the close, stinking room, I could not see his face. But I knew it was he, my companion, and I could smell his fever and his sickness and the stink of the dying infant, and see the gleaming body of the cat as it pawed at the child's outstretched hand. "Stop it! You've lost control of it," I screamed, surely with all my strength, but the infant screamed louder. "Make it stop!" "I cannot," he whispered. "It goes on forever. It will never stop." And with a great shriek, I kicked at the cat and sent it flying out of the filthy room, overturning the milk pail as it went. Death in all the houses of Norwood. Death in the cloister, death in the open fields. It seemed like judgment of God. I was sobbing, begging to be released. It seemed the very end of creation itself. But as night came down over the dead village, he was alive, still, stumbling up the slopes, through the forest towards that tower, where the Lord stood at the broken arch of the window, waiting for him to come. "Don't go," I begged him. I ran alongside him, crying, but he didn't hear. The Lord turned and smiled with infinite sadness as the young man on his knees begged for salvation, when it was damnation this Lord offered, when it was only damnation that the Lord could give. "Yes, damn them, but living, breathing," the young man cried, and the Lord opened his arms. The kiss again, the lethal kiss, the blood drawn out of his dying body, and then the Lord lifting the heavy head of the young man so the youth could take the blood back again from the body of the Lord himself. I screamed, do not drink." He turned, and his face was now so perfectly the visage of death that I couldn't believe there was animation left in him. Yet he asked, "What would you do? Would you go back to Norwood? Would you open those doors one after another? Would you ring the bell in the empty church? And if you did, who would hear?" He didn't wait for my answer, and I had none now to give. He locked his innocent mouth to the vein that pulsed with every semblance of life beneath the Lord's cold and translucent flesh, and the blood jetted into the young body, vanquishing in one great burst the fever and the sickness that had racked it, driving it out along with the mortal life. He stood now in the hall of the Lord alone. Immortality was his, and the bloodthirst he would need to sustain it, and that thirst I could feel with my whole soul. And each and everything was transfigured in his vision, to the exquisite essence of itself. A wordless voice spoke from the starry veil of heaven. It sang in the wind that rushed through the broken timbers. It sat in the flames that ate at the sooted stones of the hearth. It was the eternal rhythm of the universe that played beneath every surface as the last living creature in the village, that tiny child, fell silent in the maw of time. A soft wind sifted and scattered the soil from the newly turned furrows in the empty field. The rain fell from the black and endless sky. Years and years passed, and all that had been Norwood melted into the earth. The forest sent out its silent sentinels, and mighty trunks rose where there had been huts and houses, where there had been monastery walls. And it seemed a horror beyond all horrors that no one should know any more of those who had lived and died in that small and insignificant village, that not anywhere in the great archives in which all history is recorded should a mention of Norwood exist. Yet one remained who knew, one who had witnessed, one who had seen the ramblings come in the years that followed, seen them raise their house upon the very slope where the ancient castle had once stood, one who saw New Village collect itself slowly upon the unmarked grave of the old. And all through the walls of Rambling Gate were the stones of that old castle, the stones of the forgotten monastery, the stones of that little church. We were once again back in the tower. "It is my shrine," he whispered, "my sanctuary. It is the only thing that endures as I endure. And you love it as I love it. Julie, you have written it. You love its grandeur and its gloom. Yes, yes, as it's always been." I was crying, though I didn't move my lips. He had turned to me from the window, and I could feel his endless craving with all my heart. "What else do you want from me?" I pleaded. "What else can I give?" A torrent of images answered me. It was beginning again. I was once again relinquishing myself. Yet in a great rush of lights and noise, I was enlivened and made whole, as I had been when we rode together through the forest. But it was into the world of now, this hour, that we passed. We were flying through the rural darkness along the railway towards London, where the nighttime city burst like an enormous bubble in a shower of laughter and motion and glaring light. He was walking with me under the gas lamps, his face all but shimmering with that same dark innocence, that same irresistible warmth. It seemed we were holding tight to each other in the very midst of a crowd, and the crowd was a living thing, a writhing thing, and everywhere there came a dark, rich aroma from it, the aroma of fresh blood. Women in white fur, gentlemen in opera capes swept through the brightly lighted doors of the theater. The blare of music hall undulated us and then faded away. Only a thin soprano voice was left, singing a high plaintive song. I was in his arms and his lips were covering mine. And there came that dull, zinging sensation again, that great, uncontrollable opening within myself. Thirst, and the promise of satiation measured only by the intensity of that thirst. Up back staircases, we fled together into high-ceilinged bedrooms papered in red damask, where the loveliest women reclined on brass beds, and the aroma was so strong now that I could not bear it, and he said, "Drink. They are your victims. They will give you eternity. You must drink." And I felt the warmth filling me, charging me, blurring my vision, until we broke free again, light and invisible. It seemed as we moved over the rooftops and down again through rain-drenched streets. But the rain did not touch us. The falling snow did not chill us. We had within ourselves a great and indissoluble heat. And together in the carriage we talked to each other in low, exuberant rushes of language. We were lovers. We were constant. We were immortal. We were as enduring as Ramblingate. Oh, don't let it stop. I felt his arms around me, and I knew we were in the tower room together, and the vision had worked their fatal alchemy. Do you understand why I am offering you? To your ancestors, I revealed myself. Yes, I subjugated them. But I would make you my bride, Julie. I would share with you my power. Come with me. I will not take you against your will. But can you turn away? Again, I heard my own scream. My hands were on his cool white skin, and his lips were gentle yet hungry, his eyes yielding and ever young. Father's angry countenance blazed before me as if I too had the power to conjure. Unspeakable horror. I covered my face. He stood against the backdrop of the window, against the distant drift of pale clouds. The candlelight glimmered in his eyes. Immense and sad and wise they seemed, and oh yes, innocent. As I have said again and again, you are their fairest flower, Julie. To them I gave my protection always. To you I give my love. Come to me, dearest, and Ramblingate will truly be yours, and it will finally truly be mine. Nights of argument, but finally Richard had come round. He would sign over Ramblingate to me, and I should absolutely refuse to allow the place to be torn down. There would be nothing he could do then to obey Father's command. I had given him the legal impediment he needed, and of course, I told him I would leave the house to his male heirs. It should always be in Rampling hands. A clever solution, it seemed to me, since Father had not told me to destroy the place. I had no scruples in the matter now at all. And what remained was for him to take me to that little railway station and see me off for London, not worry about my going home to Mayfair on my own. "You stay here as long as you wish, and do not worry," I said. I felt more tenderly towards him than I could ever express. "You knew as soon as you set foot in the place that Father was quite wrong." The great black locomotive was chugging past us, the passengers, cars, slowing to a stop. "Must go now, darling. Kiss me," I said. "But what came over you, Julie? What convinced you so quickly? We've been through all that, Richard, I said. What matters is that Rambling Gate is safe, and we are both happy, my dear. I waved until I couldn't see him any more. The flickering lamps of the town were lost in the deep lavender light of the early evening, and the dark hulk of Rambling Gate appeared for one uncertain moment like the ghost of itself on the nearby rise. I sat back and closed my eyes. Then I opened them slowly, savoring this moment for which I had waited so long. He was smiling, seated in the far corner of the leather seat opposite, as he had been all along, and now he rose with a swift, almost delicate movement and sat beside me and enfolded me in his arms. "It's 5 hours to London," he whispered. "I can wait," I said, feeling the thirst like a fever, as I held tight to him, feeling his lips against my eyelids and my hair. "I want to hunt the London streets tonight," I confessed a little shyly, but I saw only approbation in his eyes. "Beautiful Julie, my Julie," he whispered. "You'll love the house in Mayfair," I said. "Yes," he said. "And when Richard finally tires of Rambling Gate, we shall go home."